Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that registrations will be opening very soon for my next 12-week transformation program. Stepping Out from Behind the Smile is an immersive container that guides you through my holistic transformation model, helping you to step off the hamster wheel and start living a life you love. Whether you're looking to address your relationship with food, alcohol, money, or relationships, this program is designed to give you the tools you need to create a meaningful life on purpose. If you're interested in finding out more, you can DM me the word ready, or alternatively, you can contact me through my website and we'll set up a time to connect. It's important I let you know that these groups run at limited numbers. Now, I do this intentionally so that it's an intimate space for you to do the deep inner work. But because of this, spots are limited and the April intake is already filling up. I can't wait to see you inside the container for a life-transforming experience. Welcome to Behind the Smile with Ash Butters, a podcast designed to reveal the truth behind the masks we wear. Together, we look to demystify the human mind and its behaviours in relation to mental health, trauma, and addiction. My name's Ash, and I'll be your host as we uncover the real stories of people's pain and the steps they've taken to live a life of freedom in recovery. From sobriety to spirituality, join me each week as we uncover the reasons why people seek recovery and how their lives have changed by living one day at a time. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Behind the Smile. I am so excited for today's episode. Here in the studio with me, I have David Tatau. Now, David is a speaker, a mindset coach, an entrepreneur, and a mental health advocate. Now, funnily enough, I met David through my dad, Rod, who, if you've listened to previous episodes, you'll know all about Dad. And so David and Dad met at an event a little while ago, my understanding, you may correct me differently, and they hit it off. And then Dad actually invited David to attend one of my yoga workshops. So that's how David and I met. And we really hit it off. We have a lot of values that are in alignment and we share the same mission. So I was beyond excited to have the opportunity for you to join me here today in the studio. So I guess let me start by saying welcome. Welcome, 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 David. How are you today?
I am so excited to be here. Thank you for the warm welcome. Thank you for having me in your beautiful house, Ash, and in these really comfy chairs.
The chairs are epic, aren't they?
Yeah, they're life-changing, genuinely.
They're a new addition.
Just when I thought I wouldn't stop sinking, I keep on doing it. So it's amazing. Thank you.
Great feedback. Thank you. Awesome. And tell me, how's your morning been so far?
Wonderful. Yeah, I woke up, I did some study, I went to the gym, and the sauna reinvigorated me, and then had a lovely drive across town to your place, which was nice.
Brilliant. It sounds like you got a lot done considering that we met at 9:30 in the morning.
True.
Yeah. What time did you wake up, out of curiosity?
This morning I woke up at 4:45.
Wow. Is that a normal wake up?
It depends. Usually between 4:30 and 6 a.m. most days. Mm. Yeah.
Why?
I like to be up before calls and emails come through, and it's a very peaceful time to kind of do a bit of practice and study, like I said before, and just get my mind, I suppose, primed and ready and grateful and excited for the day ahead.
Mm, I love that. It's all about those habits, isn't it? The things that we do, even when we don't want to, but we know that they're going to be good for us in the long run. I actually just shared about this on Instagram this morning because I had a similar experience where when my alarm went off this morning, it wasn't 4:45, it was a little bit later. It was about 6 a.m., which is kind of a sleep in for me, but I was still really tired. And the first thought that went through my head was, Ash, prioritize your sleep. You didn't get enough sleep last night. This is what you need. And then I stopped and I actually thought, is that true? And when I played the tape forward, I actually thought to myself, I may be a little bit tired, but I know that the benefits I will receive by getting myself up and out of the house before my day starts, I know that they are going to be greater than the extra hour of sleep. And so I did. I got myself up. I got myself out, down to the beach. I went for a walk. I was able to meditate, connect with nature, get direct sunlight into my eyes, which will then help me sleep tonight. Like all of these benefits that I was able to receive as a result of doing what felt uncomfortable at the time, but would give me great comfort in the long run.
I love that. Yeah. And I think, you know, asking that question is great because you do get a chance to kind of check in with yourself and really understand is your body telling you that it genuinely needs rest, or is it maybe like an old pattern of behavior that's trying to keep you stuck and feeling comfortable? I think that's such a healthy way to go about it, because sometimes you genuinely do need some time to rest, and you know, I'll have a nap or I'll have an earlier night and check in with myself more regularly. It sounds like you're very in tune with your body and you know when to give it the rest it needs, which is so important.
Nowadays, absolutely. Let me be honest, that took me a long time to be able to do. And I definitely think having a regular yoga practice and, you know, a daily meditation practice allows me to do that and really supports me in that. But it's something that I have definitely fine-tuned over time for sure.
True.
Yeah.
I love that.
All right. So David, let's allow our audience to get to know you a little bit better. Can we kick it off with where do you live? What does an average day look like? And what do you do for fun?
Love that. So I live in Fitzroy in Melbourne, Victoria. And a typical day looks like me starting with studies. So I work with a coach of my own at the moment and learning just about how to make a bigger impact and really focusing on the causes of that, which is, you know, the inner work on myself and building a stronger relationship with myself through gratitude, through discipline. So I'll do that in the morning. I'll go to the gym, which is usually composed of a relatively short rings workout. Shout out to my friend Jack Woods, who has developed an awesome program that's very effective.
Hang on a minute. What is a rings workout?
Yeah, good one. So gymnastics rings.
So you like the ones that you hang from?
Yeah, those ones.
Oh my goodness, yeah. How cool.
Very cool. Yeah, I used to think it just wasn't for me, but hands down, probably one of the most humbling tools in the gym. And so I don't need to spend too much time on those before I get tired. And then I'll finish up with my arch nemesis, yet also a friend, the rowing machine. So I used to row at school and uni. And yeah, I think it's one of the most demanding machines ever created, but certainly makes a real difference and sets me up for an awesome day. So after that and the sauna that I do, I'll have either some sessions with clients or I'll work on creating new content for different channels. You know, I might go for a walk in the park just to, like you mentioned before, just connect with some green and some nature. I'm on a tuna rotation at the moment, so I'll put together a yummy tuna melt for lunch.
A tuna rotate. I was trying to work out what that was, as in like the fish that swim tuna.
That's it. Yeah,
yeah, right.
Yeah, I go through periods where I have like, you know, I'll just have one meal that I'll eat for like a few weeks at a time.
Really?
Just to make it easy. And then I'll switch teams to a different one.
Oh my gosh, I could not do that. I need variety. I can't even stand having the same thing the day after the night before. Like if I have leftovers, it's like I need something different every day.
True. So what do you do? Do you plan out different meals each day or how do you go about it?
I've actually been working with a fitness coach since the start of the year. Shout out Bec Gibbs. And she's been incredible. She's really helped me reframe my relationship with food. I've always had a really unhealthy, dysfunctional relationship with food from about the age of, I think, 5 or 6. You know, at first it was more an addictive tendency where I would use sugar as a way to make me feel good. And then it became restrictive in months from about the age of 12. And then drugs and alcohol entered my life. And, you know, I've never really had healthy eating habits. And Bec has given me meal plans, which I use. So there's, you know, a guide for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and then any snacks that I might have throughout the day. And what I love about these programs is nothing is restricted. Like on one of the meal plans, there's a Freddo frog.
And awesome.
On one of the meal plans, there's a paddle pop ice cream. So I don't ever feel like I'm missing out. But what it's teaching me to do is that I can eat a balanced amount of food, like fats, carbs, protein. And it's all to do with the portions and you know, I weigh everything. But it has dramatically shift my perspective around food and my relationship with food and what I can eat, because I'm still getting results even though
I'm eating things that in my mind I've always been conditioned to think are bad, you know. I'm using air quotes for those that aren't watching the video right now. And it's been so transformative mentally, physically, but also spiritually as well.
That is incredible. I'm so happy for you, Ash. Yeah, it sounds like Beck's program has helped you develop just such a healthy relationship with food as well.
Yeah, that's
and
it.
And enjoy
it.
Things in moderation. Yes. I feel like sometimes we think, oh, you know, I can't have chocky at all, or, you know, I can't have a pizza or anything like that. I just have to be clean 100% of the time. And it's like...
And that's what I used to do. No surprise, recovering alcoholic and addict. But I would say, like, I can't have this, and so I would restrict, and then I would think to myself, well, I don't want to live a life where I never have that again. And so then I would just hit the fuck it button, and then I'd go crazy on that for a period of time, and it was just always so up and down, and nothing ever felt sustainable. I think that's the main difference now, is that I can see myself eating like this for the rest of my life and not having any negative feeling about that whatsoever. There's a freedom in it, you know.
So liberating.
Yeah, that's exactly amazing. Right. Okay, so tell me, what do you do for fun?
So I love DJing. I'm a really big fan of music. My partner, Annabelle, also known as DJ Bell, is a huge inspiration for me. We actually learned DJing together when we were living together at college, and any opportunity that I can get, you know, when I'm with friends, you know, or at an event or at a party together, just, you know, getting on the decks and mixing tunes is so much fun. It's genuinely a form of therapy for me in some ways. I get a chance to express myself, to share, you know, sounds and tunes with the friends that I love, and yeah, just connect with people that. In a meaningful way. Yeah.
I love that. Thank you for sharing. Now, David, as you know, the format of the show is that I ask guests to bring in a photo from a time in their life where they were hiding behind a smile. So you've brought in a photo today, and I would love you to firstly describe the photo for our listeners, and then can you please talk about what was happening at this time in your life?
For sure. So in the photo, I'm dressed in a turtleneck, one of my favorite jackets, and I've got Annabelle, my beautiful partner, on my side. And yeah, there's a bit of a half smile in there. I think covering up a lot of pain and anguish and just hopelessness that I was experiencing at that point in my life. A lot of that was in large part due to the fact that I just couldn't find my feet in a career. You know, I'd finished university. I didn't achieve the goals and expectations that my parents had of me, which kind of put me in a very sad and depressed state.
What were they exactly?
Well, there was an expectation that, you know, I would, after finishing biomedicine, which was my undergrad, to go on to practice medicine, become a doctor. And then when I fell short of those expectations, you know, my parents didn't take it well, you know, in my eyes. And when I decided to, you know, change direction and try, you know, a new career and find my feet, you know, in sales, which is what I was working in at the time, in different industries, in fitness, healthcare, pharmaceuticals. Yeah, it was just quite, I think, disappointing on some ways for them.
Mm-hmm.
And also it was quite a struggle for me. I think I had a bit of a crisis of identity because I didn't know where I fit in or where I belonged. A lot of workplaces made me feel uncomfortable. I was telling you before, you know, in one instance when I, you know, was really carrying a lot of this emotional burden and it was affecting my performance in the workplace, instead of my manager, you know, compassionately, curiously checking in with me and asking how I'm going, she put me on a performance improvement plan and tried to manage me out of the organization. So it was like little instances like those, or working for people who embodied a lot of, I think, toxic values of, you know, bigotry and racism and misogyny and homophobia. And it was just kind of mind-boggling to think that this kind of behavior exists in the workplace, and consistently being subjected to that and hating going to work and even waking up to bring myself to support the mission of people like that made me hate myself to tell you the truth. So I think, yeah, there's that photo. You know, if you look closely, you can tell that it's quite a fake, inauthentic smile. There's a lot going on behind the scenes.
Yeah. So what was going on with your mental health at that time?
I was, frankly, in shambles. I tried to navigate the mental health care system for support, and after speaking to many different GPs and going through the, you know, naturally quite a clinical approach with doing the K10 and, you know, checking in and, you know, where do you fit in this box? And again, bounced around different psychologists and different medications. I struggled to find any form of relief, to tell you the truth, Ash. You know, a lot of the medication that I was on created more harm than good. And I actually never felt truly comfortable enough opening up. Now, what I will say is now I have an amazing psychologist who, you know, asks me really empowering, thought-provoking questions, you know, makes me feel like I'm making progress towards the best version of myself. But back then it was a struggle. And I like to think of it now and share with, you know, your listeners as well, for those who, you know, might be seeking support or might know someone who's seeking support, that, you know, if you don't find the right therapy or the right person for you who you, you know, gel with, or treatment approach that might not work the first time, just know that, you know, the right approach is out there for you. And I think it's a matter of trial and error and really, you know, being vulnerable, which is, you know, much easier said than done, but, you know, continuously searching, as I have, made a difference. So yeah, to kind of circle back, you know, my mental health was in shambles, and not being able to find the right support through the healthcare system kind of dashed my hopes in ever feeling any better, which is when I became quite reliant on alcohol and drugs to cope.
That was going to be my next question, and we've gone there. So thank you for that. You've done it my job for me. So how were you managing at that time? How were you self-soothing or self-medicating? What did it look like?
Well, I mean, every week, at least, you know, once or twice a week, I would, you know, go out till ungodly hours in the morning and take all kinds of different drugs and drink myself silly and just end up hating how I felt. And, you know, I didn't have anything purposeful or a passion that I could really meaningfully distract myself with, like a healthy obsession, you know. And so I didn't have work that I could plunge into with my heart and soul and really find joy in. I just had a job that I hated and then an escape to try and soothe that sort of pain with. So yeah, and you've talked about this on other episodes, which I really appreciate. You know, these addictions, they're actually, you know, a solution, you know, until they become a problem. And I think that they definitely were a solution for me during that period of time. I think in some ways they saved my life.
Yeah. Okay, I want to go back for a moment, David. You touched on the fact that you felt this pressure from your parents to achieve a certain level of success, to become a doctor, to study medicine. I'd love to understand a little bit more about your childhood and your upbringing. Was that something that you experienced from the early outset? And what were some significant memories in your childhood that you think perhaps shaped your pathway to adulthood?
Such an awesome question. And I think, you know, to set the context for my upbringing, it's important to mention that my parents came from Romania. So they're, you know, migrants, refugees. They landed in 1991 and, you know, went through just immense suffering and pain to be able to be here. For instance, you know, they were sleeping on park benches in some instances. They lived in refugee camps for 18 to 24 months and were exposed to a lot of, you know, discrimination when they arrived here, you know, people calling them gypsies and, you know, not giving them the opportunities that they wanted. And so I think that created a sense of insecurity. And, you know, they're both incredibly high achievers. They did very well when they were at school and university and, you know, incredibly well here to be able to put me through a private school and, you know, to create, you know, abundant opportunities for me, the kind of opportunities they never had. But, you know, when I was growing up, it did feel like there was that pressure to be able to perform and to, you know, ensure that the opportunities that they'd given me would not be squandered. And I think what really amplified that pressure was the fact that, you know, they, you know, the notion of getting a divorce was something that was raised when I was three. But after a lot of back and forth between them, they decided to stay together for my own benefit until I finished school. So for 15 years, you can only imagine what kind of, you know, resentment and tension, potentially even hatred, had been brewing for, you know, a young, impressionable mind to just be exposed and subjected to. So I think there was a lot that shaped my journey between the pressure to perform well and also sort of seeing, I guess, feeling like a burden in some ways, you know, keeping my parents together.
Did you have knowledge of that at the time, or is this something that you found out later after the fact?
I had no idea.
Yeah. I had a similar experience where I think I was around 10 years old the first time mum and dad spoke about getting a divorce, and I was 18 when they finally did it.
Right.
And I know for me personally, that really impacted what I observed to look like a healthy, functional relationship, which then played out into the way I showed up in relationships later on in life. Did you have any sort of experience like that? Like, what was modeled to you? Because I'm imagining a healthy, loving relationship wasn't what you saw.
And I'm just curious, so like how was that modeled in the relationships that you know, went into?
So I think for me, and Dad knows, I've spoken about this before, Dad was quite absent. He was working with St Kilda Footy Club at the time. There was a lot of evening things that both he and Mum were attending. So I felt a lot of abandonment, which created in me an anxious attachment. So I've always, you know, previously gone into relationships with more of that anxious attachment style and really wanting to move things quickly, to like lock things down so that I can feel that sense of safety and security. I also think I saw a lot of toxicity in that Mum and Dad really did love each other a lot. And it was when they were loving each other, it was obvious, it was very clear. There was physical touch. And there was all of these overt behaviors that I observed. But then at the same time, when things turned, which was usually when alcohol was involved, I saw like a lot of really negative behaviors, a lot of yelling, things being thrown. Not that I ever replicated that, but I definitely yelled in previous relationships. I don't think I ever threw anything. Any exes can correct me if I'm wrong on that. But yeah, like just not a safe environment, I think. And it's really interesting because when I talk about the current relationship I'm in, which I do reference here on the show, the word I use to describe it is safe. And it's the healthiest relationship I've ever been in, but it's taken me a really long time to figure that out because it wasn't modeled to me as a child.
Thank you so much for sharing, Ash. Yeah, and it sounds like, you know, you had to go through those relationships to really understand how you operate and what behaviors you're, you know, you're kind of modeling off your parents as well. So, yeah, I appreciate that. And definitely, I think in many ways I was the same. I adopted that anxious attachment style and really was afraid of abandonment and, you know, being rejected and, you know, being left alone, you know, which is exactly how I felt after my parents divorced. So,
so how old were you when that happened?
18. That was just at the end of
school. Same. Yeah, same
as you.
But you were an only child, right?
Yes.
That must have been really hard, because I know for my brother and I, when my parents separated, we actually grew really, really close. In fact, we went and got tattoos. Like, I went and got my first ever tattoo. I was 17, and I've got my brother's initial on my foot, which is like part of an anklet, and he's got Ash on his arm. And that was, you know, we were super close at that time. So I really feel for you that you didn't have the support of a sibling to help navigate that chapter of your life.
No, thank you, Ash. Yeah, and I'm so touched to hear that brought you closer. It sounded like, you know, you and your brother, you know, bonded and found strength in each other's presence, which is so important. You know, it was really hard. And I think in some ways, whilst there was a lot of suffering associated with that, I'm grateful that I did go through that, because it just meant that I had to be more resourceful and resilient and develop that kind of, you know, strength and vulnerability to ask for help from others, from friends and from professionals. So yeah, it's, you know, I'm grateful for it. It's made me who I am today.
And how is your relationship with your parents today?
Honestly, it's quite fractured. I don't see either of them. And whilst I love them to bits and I'm grateful for everything that they've done for me, there is still a lot of that negative programming that they've carried along with them as a result of all the the trauma they faced through migrating and navigating a very emotionally, you know, dramatic and taxing divorce. And so whilst both of them have found love with other partners, and I'm really happy to see them do that, you know, I'm very conscious and selective about who I choose to spend my time and energy with.
Mm.
And unfortunately, you know, every time I see my parents, I do feel worse, and I feel like my energy has been zapped, and I don't get the kind of unconditional support and love and encouragement that I would expect. And that's okay. Mm. You know, no family is perfect. And I acknowledge that, and I'm, you know, grateful that I get to create my own family, and that's okay.
It sounds like you've done a lot of healing to get to that point, because as you were talking, I was thinking about the David that had that sense of abandonment and that action, that anxious attachment. And what would come with that would be a desire to want to keep the family together at any cost because of the fear of being alone. So that's why I say you must have done a lot of work to come to this place where you are willing to let go of relationships that don't serve you or prioritize your own health and well-being over the need to people please, to protect, to try and keep this family unit together. Like, how did you get to that point? Because I think for some people that's a life's journey.
Yeah, thank you for seeing me and sharing that. You know, like I said, a lot of trial and error through the mental health care system. And I think whilst, you know, psychology and talk therapy is so important and I really value it and it helps me, as it does for so many people, I think it is one part of the, and so I'm blessed to have been, to have worked with a lot of, you know, somatic healers and seen, you know, active tension and not be completely released from my body, and just hours and hours of cascading tears and like emotional shifts take place as a result of this, you know, burden that I was carrying. So I think, like I said before, and through the work that I've done as well, I really believe in the importance of being vulnerable, because that's how we get to, you know, shed the layers and, you know, get rid of things that don't serve us and just connect with people in a really authentic way. And as a result of doing that and working with different healers and therapists, I've just gotten to a place now where I can comfortably acknowledge, you know, what serves me and what doesn't, and just be okay with that.
That's beautiful. Well done. Well done. That's amazing. Yeah. Okay. So I'm really curious. You were describing the photo to me earlier and you were saying that you'd gotten to this point in your life where you'd gone to university, you were now working in corporate, but you were feeling quite unfulfilled. And I'm imagining that, you know, your soul wasn't being set on fire, but that's very different from the person that sits across from me today. You're very embodied, very connected, and I know that you're passionate about what you do in supporting other humans and working within the mental health space. So can you help me draw a line in between the dots? Like, how did we get from that guy in the photo to the man that sits in front of me today?
Yeah, gladly. Thank you, Ash. So like I mentioned, you know, that my experience in the workplace at that time was met with a lot of angst and hopelessness. I didn't really know which direction I was heading in. And there was an emotional impact which triggered my decision to change course. And that was taken in the shape of me mustering up the courage really to open up to my dad about what I was going through. And it was really hard to do, because growing up, you know, I perceived him to be quite closed off emotionally, you know, embodying a lot of those archaic masculine stereotypes of, you know, soldiering on and, you know, keeping his cards quite close to his chest. So I didn't really know what to expect when I opened up to him. You know, I thought he would just tell me to put up, shut up and get on with it, which is the narrative that I was raised on throughout my childhood. But, you know, when I did, something really special happened. He listened to me. He validated what I was going through. And then I think almost as if he felt he now had permission to open up to me, you know, for the very first time about all the trauma he faced as a migrant, and then, you know, navigating the emotional turmoil of his divorce and the attempt to end his life.
Oh, and wow.
Yeah. And, you know, whilst it was incredibly confronting at first, you know, it actually brought us a lot closer together. And, you know, those conversations were healing in nature. We weren't trying to fix each other's problems because I don't think we knew how to. Mm. We were really just holding space for one another and purposefully sharing our own challenges and, you know, helping each other feel heard and seen and understood. And, you know, we didn't know what we were doing at the time, but we were practicing peer support with one another. And that really seeded the idea for Linkmate, which is a company that I built in the mental health space, which was really based on the premise that when people come together to share their experiences, you know, without trying to diagnose, without trying to fix, and just holding space, something really special happens. You know, there's a bond that's created. You know, if you think about the last time, you know, you perhaps spoke to someone who had grappled with addiction, and you know, there's this kind of unspoken bond and really powerful connection that gets forged. And so, you know, we developed an app as a bit of a social network for peer support where people could connect with trained peer support volunteers to be able to, yeah, access proactive emotional support to kind of share their emotions in a safe space with the intention of helping them, you know, stop their challenges become more overwhelming in nature where they might, you know, need, you know, clinical support. Mm-hmm. So that was an amazing journey. You know, we grew the app to support thousands across Australia, even India. We ran workshops and, you know, built an amazing team of really heart-centered storytellers, each with their own lived experience, sharing their journeys with mental health, which we did in corporate, which was such an amazing full circle moment for me.
Oh, I bet it was.
Yeah. I remember in one instance, you know, we ran a workshop and at the end, one of the senior leaders actually got up and candidly shared his own journey with mental health in front of, you know, 50 odd employees. And for someone who had, you know, experienced the exact opposite of that, I was completely shook. So, you know, to be able to have that experience was incredibly inspiring and also different to a lot of what other people in my circles had done. And after speaking with them and seeing how others around me also had their own passions and interests and ideas to build something of their own, I just felt a calling to move into coaching. And so through Linkmate, we partnered with Beyond Blue, who's looking after our community now. And since then, I've been working with a lot of 9-to-5 professionals and entrepreneurs who, you know, might be experiencing the same challenges I did, a lot of self-doubt, perhaps hopelessness, feeling stuck in their career, which doesn't feel fulfilling, but have dreams to do more and be more, whether it is, you know, to rise into a leadership position or start, you know, a purposeful business of their own. So yeah, that's what I'm helping them with now. And everything that I do is grounded in that lived experience, because I think that's important for people to, like I said before, feel that powerful connection and support as a peer.
Mm, absolutely. The power of identification when you can see yourself in somebody else. And that's part of the reason why I started this podcast, was because I wanted to be able to share a range of different stories from people from all walks of life talking about their relationship with mental health, trauma, and addiction, to really show people that you don't have to be living under a bridge drinking spirits out of a brown paper bag to qualify. Like, and you know, and I'm curious to know, you know, particularly on the lens of mental health, again, I think a lot of people don't think they qualify for support because they're not as bad as the next person. And, you know, we look for the differences rather than the similarities. And not only that, I think that there's still a stigma. And particularly in, I think it's in all industries, but let's just use corporate as an example. If you're wanting to rise the ranks and to move up, I would imagine that there's going to be a resistance to go to HR and put your hand up and say, hey, I'm actually struggling right now, for fear of that impacting your performance reviews or your succession plan. Like, what have you seen in relation to that?
Yeah, thank you for raising that. And it's such a very real issue that you've touched on, Ash. You know, I think, and having gone through that personally, you know, and learned from that, I realized that that's not a workplace that I want to be a part of, you know. And I think there is value in standing up for what you believe in and really, you know, building a coalition or even independently working to try and change the narrative, which I have tried on a number of occasions to kind of go to HR and, you know, raise issues in the way that certain situations have been handled and explore how behaviors in the office had made employees feel and how it had affected their mental health. But, you know, on one specific instance, unfortunately, it was all brushed under the rug and labeled a misunderstanding. And then that status quo was maintained. And so I think, like, I love and respect and encourage anyone, you know, who goes through anything like that to raise it with HR and to really push for a more mentally healthy workplace. If there isn't a behavior change, then, you know, I would encourage you to reflect on how healthy it is for you to be a part of that workplace, and if rising to the ranks of an organization like that is something that would make you feel comfortable.
Yeah, no, you raise a really good point. What do you think about, in relation to the stigma, I want to stay on this for a moment. I think, you know, since COVID, the conversations around mental health, you know, it's a different lens today and there is a much louder voice and a greater awareness. But I do still think that people see it as a bad thing. You know, not necessarily in the circles that we move in, but when I talk to people who aren't in recovery or aren't, you know, in mental health, there's a resistance, there's a fear. Like, what do you think we need to do to be able to shift that?
Honestly, Ash, what you're doing right now, I love it. And you know, I'm so grateful for you and your show because, you know, it's conversations like these that are changing the narrative. You know, collectively, it's having conversations like these openly and freely. And, you know, I use an analogy, and I think the kind of world that I want to live in, which, you know, I'm trying to embody every day, is to have conversations about mental health and, you know, challenging emotions in the same way that you talk to friends about what you got up to on the weekend, you know, and really normalizing it to that level where, you know, you can comfortably flag what you're going through and your friend can hold space for you without judgment and they can do the same. And it's received, you know, in a really comforting way. So that's what I think can make a really big difference.
Yeah, I actually agree. And I'm smiling and nodding at the moment because it's one of the things that I've really noticed shift for me since stepping into recovery is that, you know, I'm part of 12-Step Fellowship. And one of the most beautiful things about that community is when you walk in the doors and somebody asks, how are you? You answer honestly. Mm. And so it's very rare that you'll hear someone say, I'm fine. Or that. I'm okay. It's like, well, this is going on for me right now. And we get, they're very deep, rich conversations where you go straight to the heart at the very beginning of the conversation rather than sort of dancing around it or engaging in small talk, which these days I can find so supremely exhausting.
Oh.
Maybe that's what, like, to be able to replicate that environment on a global scale, I think would be a beautiful thing because then we would all feel safe to have these conversations without fear of judgment or, you know, the negative impacts of what may come from just showing up authentically. Because I think that's what it is at the end of the day, right? It's permission to show up authentically.
Absolutely. Yeah. And thank you for sharing that. That's just so awesome to hear that people feel comfortable, you know, in the fellowship to actually truly express what they're going through. Because I think, and I want to touch on this because as you were talking, it just reminded me of a very real phenomenon that we experience or may see every single day where you fall into the, how are you, good, what about you? Yeah, not bad pattern of behavior, which, you know, I think takes a lot of conscious control to break and undo. So, you know, for those listening, you might see it, you know, and you might hear it, you might even be doing it yourself. And so I think the best way to break the stigma is to acknowledge when that's happening, if it does happen for you. And be curious about how you really are feeling, how you've been going through, what you've been going through, and then being curious about what the other person has been going through as well.
Yes, it's so important, isn't it, to actually hold space for the other person as well. You've just reminded me of a conversation I had a couple of days ago. I was on the phone to a sober girlfriend and she asked me that question. She said, and how are you? And the way she asks is always with intention. And I know that she's asking me because she's truly interested in the response that I'm going to give her. So it's not just like a, hey, how are you? Like it's, hey, how are you? What's going on for you right now? And there was silence and she said, are you okay? And I said, I'm just thinking of how to respond. And what I meant by that was I want to give you, because my automatic response is still to go, oh yeah, I'm good. But what I do now and what I practice is the pause in all areas of my life. But in this instance as well, it's a beautiful thing to try. So anyone listening along, next time someone asks you, how are you? Just count to three and actually check in with your heart, with your soul. How am I? And then try to respond authentically. And then in doing so, when you open up vulnerably, that space is created for then that other person to show up vulnerably as well.
That is amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Oh, such a pleasure.
What a great tool.
It's beautiful. It's so, so good. I love authentic chats. Okay, so I want to know, what do you think is the biggest gap that we have in the mental health system here today in Australia? Or what's the biggest challenge we're facing?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I think, and it's something that we've been dealing with for a long time, is that missing middle where, you know, there are so many people out there who are seeking support and unfortunately are being turned back by clinicians because their condition or the challenges that they're experiencing are not severe enough. And, you know, they can't be sane. And, you know, they're turned back from, tertiary healthcare services, emergency departments. And it's scary because, you know, there are so many people out there in the community that are not getting the support that they need and feel not only lost, I guess, but also just the fact that, you know, it creates such a toxic comparison between, you know, their condition and others. And you were talking about this before, Ash, about, you know, severity versus just being different. You know, I don't think it's about, you know, my trauma is worse than yours. It's just it's just different. So, you know, that's tough. And that's, I think, what we tried to tackle through Linkmate, to give people a space where they could actually access support freely and early, you know, especially if they felt like their challenges didn't warrant a psychologist or they were blatantly told that as well. What about you? What are your thoughts?
Oh, I think for me, what I observe with people when I'm working with people in this space is that there is a resistance to really acknowledge what's going on. And so we label it other things, you know, like, and we use different distractions to escape the uncomfortable feeling inside. And so I think that there, you know, like, the statistics show, the World Health Organization has recently said, you know, 1 in 8 people live with a mental health disorder. I think it's probably far greater than that. But we don't talk about it. And it is, it's this shame, it's this stigma that if I'm experiencing poor mental health, then something must be wrong with me. And therefore I am bad. And that plays into our negative core beliefs, right? And then that, you know, perpetuates this shame spiral and this cycle. And so I think the main thing that, once again, that we've both been echoing today is like just being able to share and to have the conversation, whether that is with a mental health professional, your doctor, or just a friend. You know, I think like we need to be talking more to normalize the conversation. You've worked a lot with men, in particular men's mental health, and I'd love to know what would be the main difference between what you observe with the mental health challenges that men face versus women?
A lot of the challenges are quite similar across the board. Fundamentally, I think it comes down to an issue of self-image, which is actually, for those that are playing along at home, I gave Ash a book called Psycho-Cybernetics, which really explores the self-image. And that really is the image or the picture that we hold of ourselves in our minds, like our minds think in pictures. And so the reason I bring it up is because when we have a low image of ourselves, it can lead to different tendencies, for instance, eating disorders or addiction, right? And I think, you know, when we don't have a healthy relationship with ourselves, when there's not a healthy, empowering, uplifting image that we hold of ourselves in our mind, it creates a lot of challenges. I think the only difference between men and women that I see is that, and speaking, you know, generally, and, you know, just accounting for the conversations that I've had, you know, with women and men in my circles, which is, you know, not representative of the whole population, what I've seen is that women tend to be far more expressive and open and authentic than men, which works wonders for their ability to heal and also help others heal and help men heal. So fundamentally, I think it is an issue of self-image. That's where, you know, that I had such a low image of myself that I, you know, didn't treat my body well. And, you know, I partied and I drank lots and I hated myself. You know, now I have a really healthy self-image. And so I acknowledge that I draw the line in the sand. If you know, I'm about to embark on a path of destructive, self-destructive behaviors.
There's two things I want to say to that. It just reminded me, we were talking offline before, how you were saying, I asked if you drink today and you said, yes, I do, but not that often. And how you've recently had taken a month off because you have a Bucks party that you're preparing for this weekend, which I thought was very measured and something I certainly couldn't do. But that is a way of showing that respect for your body, right? You know, like, I know I'm going to be drinking alcohol this weekend. So, you know, and if this is only for people that actually can have a healthy relationship with alcohol, let me caveat with that. But that's one way that you can show up. And then your morning practices, like that, all of those things would be contributing to this level of self-esteem that you have today and self-awareness and self-compassion. Like, it's through the action that you take on a daily basis that you've developed that. It's not like you've just waved a magic wand or decided to change your mind one day. Like, this is all through consistency and action. Going back to the men and women thing though for a moment, I want to share what I've observed. The men that I know in my life today seem to have a lot less friends than my female friends. Does that make sense? Like, I feel like females, generally speaking, you could say, how many close friends do you have? And they might be able to say 5, you know, on average, maybe 5 to 10. Whereas the males in my life, it's like 1 to 2 if they're lucky. Have you observed similar?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because what I've noticed as well is not only friends, but, you know, deep and meaningful friendships. Yeah. And, you know, the certainly I think gets more amplified and pronounced the older we get as well.
Why?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I think COVID probably has played a hand in this in terms of affecting our ability, or, you know, for some to be able to comfortably socialize in the same way that they did previously. What about you? What are your thoughts?
I think the fact that women seem to be able to share more about their feelings, I think as a result, you form deeper connections. But as to the quantity of friendships, that I'm still trying to work out. It's an interesting one, and it just seems to be this common thread. Maybe I'll open it up to social media to see what people are thinking. But I do get curious around it. And I actually heard an interesting statistic the other day, or they were talking about how for elderly couples, if the female passes away before the male will generally pass away shortly after. Whereas when the male passes away, the female can continue to live a long and happy life. And they say it's because of the female friendships. Because for the female, the male is not their closest friend a lot of the time. You know, he'll be a big part of her life, but she has all of these deep, enriched relationships. Whereas for the male, the female is their best friend. You know, their one and only. Once they go, you know, they soon go after. So, yeah, food for thought around that one, I think.
That is really interesting. Thanks for sharing that. You know, and it, you know, what that tells me is that, you know, women are just naturally more open and willing to step outside of their comfort zones and express their true feelings, whereas it sounds like, yeah, there's more work to be done to help men feel comfortable doing the same.
Yeah, and, you know, just as we're talking, like, maybe it does come back to that whole traditional idea of, like, the man doesn't talk, men don't cry. You know, what was the saying you had? Get on with it, something, like, whereas women have a little bit more space, I think, traditionally, you know, in the past to open up. So I do think that's changing over time. So, David, as I mentioned, we're here to normalize the conversation. And to do that, you know, I really want to know, like, how are you today? Because we can do all of this work and all of this healing and work in the space of mental health, but that doesn't mean that we avoid having to feel these feelings and have these experiences. Like, what is your mental health like today?
Thank you for checking in, Ash. You're a gem. You know, I think it's improving. You know, in all honesty, towards the end of last year, I was really struggling immensely. I was in a depression after, you know, exiting my last business and had a crisis of identity, you know, much like the one I had 5-6 years ago, because I think I made the mistake of just attaching, you know, every part of me to this. And without it, I felt completely lost. And so I didn't really know what to do with myself.
Mm.
You know, over the past few months, I feel blessed to have been able to, you know, in some ways organically fall into this coaching role and already be supporting people and feel a sense of fulfillment. But those feelings, you know, still arise. And, you know, I'm getting better at dealing with them and just, you know, holding an exciting picture in my mind of where I'm heading and what I'm doing. So yeah, all in all, I think I've made leaps and bounds from where I was a few months ago.
Mm.
And feeling more comfortable talking about it as well. So, you know, thank you for asking and holding a safe space for me to do that.
Of course, yeah. Of course, right? We've got to practice what we preach.
Yeah. So what about you? How's your mental health?
Yeah, look, today, today my mental health is good. Today I'm feeling good in my body. I'm feeling connected. We're recording this episode a couple of weeks before it's going to drop. So for context, I will be celebrating my 4-year sobriety birthday, God willing, in 2 days' time,
woohoo,
which is always a really exciting time of the year coming up to any sobriety milestone. And I was actually talking to a sponsee last night. She checked in to see how I was feeling. God bless her. And because previously in years gone by, coming up to any of these milestones, I've actually gone a bit wobbly with my mental health. And, you know, each year's looked different, but I've had years of grief for the life that I left. I've had years where I've had fear, I've had doubt. This year, I'm actually not feeling any of those things. And that's really, really nice. You know, today for me, I look a lot more for serenity and contentment than I do for happiness.
Mm.
And joy. Like, those feelings are great and I love it when that happens. But for me, like, I know I'm running well when I'm feeling really content and when I know that I am enough and that I have enough. Like, that for me is the sweet spot in life today. And I can truly say that I'm there right now. And that's not to say that I still don't have ups and downs. Like, you know, life happens. And, you know, every now and then I will have a dip in my mental health, which I seemingly can't put my finger on as to what has caused that. Mm. But what I now do today when that happens is, rather than fear it and rather than wish it away, I try to lean into what the experience is teaching me, because I know that every time I experience an emotional bottom, every time I move through discomfort, like, there's a lesson in it. And generally, the greater the pain, the greater the growth. So I do try and welcome it. And something that my dad taught me when I was going through one of these moments a couple of years ago, which was quite rough, was that, you know, the experiences that you're having, Ash, are going to be the light for somebody else later on in life. You know, you'll be able to share this with someone else who's going through the same thing, and they'll have hope because they can see that you got through it. So, yeah, I mean, that was a long-winded answer. To give you the short answer, which is I'm actually doing really well. Thank you for asking.
Thank you so much for sharing. And, you know, I'm so happy to hear that you know, you've gotten to that state and such, you know, wonderful wise words from Rod as well. Your story genuinely can be a survival guide for someone else, which is really important. Why do you think this year around you aren't getting any of those feelings of fear and doubt? Like, why do you think it's different?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think that there's a few things that are at play. I think that I have a lot more, I have a very deep connection with like a higher power today. So there is, I call it God. A lot of people might call it spirit, universe, guides, whatever it is. I just have this deep faith that I am held and that everything is going to be okay. Mm. And that as long as I keep showing up and taking the action, like, I will be looked after. And that is my faith has been deepened year upon year the longer I've been in recovery. And I do things to strengthen that. You know, my relationship with my God is like any other relationship I have in my life. The more I show up for it, the more time I invest in it, the deeper, the richer that relationship becomes. So what that looks like for me today is, you know, when you're in recovery, they teach you, they really encourage you to pray. And so I remember at the beginning, that first year, I was very structured around that practice. You know, I absolutely showed up for it, but generally I would use a prayer that was already written and I would do it, you know, after I'd meditated in the morning. And it was a little bit of a box ticking exercise, if I'm to be honest. Whereas today, what it looks like is throughout the day, multiple times a day, I'll call on this power that's greater than me, this spirit, this energy, this guide. And it's so beautiful because in that, I know that I'm never alone and that there is no need to feel fear. There is no need to try and control my life because it's already being looked after. But it's taken time to get there for sure. But I think that's been probably been the biggest difference this year, coming into this year. I think as well, I have a much greater love and respect for myself. And that's taken a long, long time. And again, the way that I've developed that is by consistently showing up for myself, because I spent 2 decades not consistently showing up for myself. I was showing up for the perception. Do you know what I mean? Like I was showing up to make sure I looked good because I needed the external validation, because if you didn't love me, then I would die. That was the story that went on in my head. Whereas today I can show up as myself, and because I have done the work to build the self-respect and the integrity, like I'm no longer so laser focused on whether or not I'm going to get the outside approval, like because I know in my heart what I'm doing is right. So there's been a lot of change in the last year, but a lot of letting go. And I think the more that I can learn to let go, hand it over, have faith, and just keep following my North Star, which is my purpose, and like the work I get to do today, helping other people, you know, on this journey is so, so meaningful and so, so rewarding, that I think all of that together has allowed me to feel really safe coming into this fifth year of sobriety, or, you know, my fourth birthday. So yeah, it's very exciting, and I'm grateful. I'm grateful for the calm. You know, Now I just need to get this same feeling on my belly button birthday, because that is still a little bit up and down, I've got to be honest. But that's a whole nother story. So, David, we're coming to the end of our conversation today, and there is one final question that I love to ask my guests. So here we go. David, what are your 3 non-negotiables that allow you to live your life today happy, joyous, and free?
That is so beautiful. 3 non-negotiables. The first one would be always showing love to every single person I meet, regardless of the circumstances. The second one would be every single day taking conscious control of my mind, you know. And an example of that is what we talked about earlier. So, you know, instead of getting swept up in that pattern of how are you, good, yeah, what about you, not bad, actually, you know, choosing to tune in and to not let, you know, myself be run by some pattern. And that's taken a lot of work, but certainly a non-negotiable. And the third one would be focusing on really healthy behaviors and habits. A lot of the stuff that you talked about, you know, the self-compassion, you know, practicing faith, making time for, you know, my health and well-being, whether that's meditation or connecting with nature or working out, or spending time with my partner, Annabelle. So showing love, taking conscious control of my mind, and always focusing on healthy behaviors.
I love that. I love that. And something I think everybody can take away and implement in their own lives. So thank you so much for sharing that. And thank you for your time today. If people want to find you, check you out, follow you, stalk you, where should they go?
They can go to my Instagram, which is David Titeu, spelled T-I-T-E-U. And yeah, from there, you know, you can learn more about the coaching that I do, the talks that I give. And yeah, please don't hesitate to send me a message. I love to hear from you and just hear, you know, what came up for you from listening to this awesome chat that I had with Ash. And if you have any questions, please shoot them.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I'll make sure I pop all of that info in the episode show notes. David, we say here on Behind the Smile that when we recover loudly, no one needs suffer in silence. So thank you so, so much for being here today and sharing your story.
Thank you, Ash. Thanks for creating such an awesome platform and spreading such a positive message. You're a gem.
Oh, bless you. Thanks, David. A big thank you for tuning in today. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by hitting the follow button and leaving a rating and review. Each rating and review helps this podcast become more discoverable so more people can hear these stories of strength and hope. Together, we will continue to remove the stigma around mental health, trauma, and addiction. Remember to reach out to those you care about, and I'll be back next week. Until then.